I wanted to take plenty of time last 2 weeks to look at strife and conflict and what James, I think, very clearly lays out as the true source and the true solution to those things. And I'm glad that we were able to look at it in some detail. If I was in a hurry, which I'm not, to get out of this book, we could probably wrap it up tonight. But we're going to get the rest of chapter 4, beginning with verse 13. And we will get the first part of chapter 5 as well. I want to get, he sort of goes on a little bit of a rant, a little bit of a diatribe against oppressive rich people in the first part of chapter 5, and he talks about the proper posture of humility when it comes to self-determination and our plans. And I think if you take everything that he's going to say in from verse 13 of chapter 4 in through the verse 6 of chapter 5, if you take it in the context of what we just have been looking at, it will make a lot more sense than just breaking it off and studying it in chunks like we're doing. It's always good to just keep an overview. I'll do a little bit of a summary tonight simply because it's warranted in the text. At a cursory glance, at a first glance of the end of chapter 4, it almost looks like James is saying that it's wrong to have plans. Before I understood a lot about God's heart, I grew up in a church that never really taught the book of James. We didn't really actually teach the Bible. Pastors just preached sermons and yelled at us on the subject du jour. But we didn't really look at things in context. I thought that that's what James was saying. And I think as we look at it in some detail tonight, we'll see that that's not what he's saying at all. It's not wrong to have plans. It's not wrong to look into the future and have ideas about what we want to do. What's wrong for God's people and what's dangerous for God's people, since we don't belong to ourselves anymore and we can't see the future, what's dangerous and wrong is when we trust in those plans more than we trust in God. And so we're going to see here a way to live that is distinctly Christian. I have to say distinctly Christian, and some of it's going to sound un-American. Because some of the things that James talks about as liabilities and no-nos in this passage are things that people in our culture, in this century, in this that we're in, pride themselves in, consider to be assets, and yet we have to take God's word as our standard to measure by. So let's look at what it says, and then let the chips fall where they may. I'm going to just take this in two chunks. I'm going to look at verses 13 through 17, and then we'll look at the first 11 verses or so of chapter 5. I will, however, in context, read it all, and then we'll look at it in those two pieces. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city and spend a year there and carry on business and make money. Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. And what is your life? You're a mist or a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. The emphasis in Greek is in the first part of that sentence. You ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this and that. And so we'll talk about that paradigm shift, a shift in a way of thinking and acting. As it is, verse 16, you boast and brag, and all such boasting is evil. Verse 17 is a summary, I believe, of everything we've looked at so far in the book of James. All the you shouldn't do this, and instead you should do this, And so we'll look at it as a summary, sort of everything so far. Anyone, then, who knows the good that he ought to do and doesn't do it, sins. Now listen, verse 5, chapter 1. You rich people, I believe the first six verses here are not speaking to believers. I think that in its context, it's speaking to people who are victimizing and exploiting others, and that he's, the little rant that he's going on is for the benefit of those, beginning in verse 7, of the believers who've been victimized and are currently being victimized by these people. And it's for their benefit that he talks about and warns about judgment. So we'll read it with that in mind. Listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that's coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted, and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You've hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages that you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. They always do. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You've fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. Interesting imagery. You have condemned and murdered innocent men who were not opposing you. Many of the verbs in those harsh sentences are verbs of customary action or habit or habitual. He's talking to people that it is their practice and custom to victimize others. I think that's a pretty good case that that's not speaking to Christians, though the book is written to Christians. But I believe that all of that was for what he's about to say. Now he addresses believers, and he says, "Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop and how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. And don't grumble against each other, brothers, or you'll be judged. The judge is standing at the door." Not the time to be picking fights on with your brothers and sisters. Brothers, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets as an example would be better syntax. Take the prophets as an example of patience in the face of suffering. The prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. Then parenthetically, you've heard of Job's perseverance. And you've seen what the Lord finally brought about. And I think the operative word in that sentence is the word finally. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. That's as far as we'll get. Notice the word patience appears four times in those few verses. I would say that's a key word. So let's go back up. Let's look at what he has to say about proper attitude towards plans, self-determining. I've had more people argue with me when I've taught the book of James over this passage than any other passage, even more than the tongue. Usually that's the one that convicts everybody. I know it convicts me. But I've seen people get irate Christians. And I always wanted to give the disclaimer, I didn't write this, okay? This is God's word, and it needs to be considered, and we will do that in some detail. He is not, though it appears to be, saying that he's saying it's wrong to have plans. That is not what he's saying, and as we look closer to it, we're going to understand. I think the key verse in understanding the last portion of chapter 4 that we're looking at in our first chunk, the key verse is verse 16. And it has to do with what I think is watered down in my NIV. In fact, it's pretty much watered down in every translation. The flavor of the words boast and brag, and where he says all such boasting is evil. He sort of talks about the kind of self-confident, arrogant plan makers as being foolish at first, but then he gets even stronger and he says, no, this kind of boastful bragging is not just foolish, it's evil. The flavor of the Greek words has with it, and you can write this in your parentheses and in your margins if you want to, or not, but it has to do with presumptuous arrogance. Let me read you three lines from the dictionary, the Greek dictionary of this word for boasting. Braggart talk, insolent, insolence which trusts in its own power and resources, impious presumption which trusts in the stability of earthly things. So they're fat words, they're strong words. And it may be that none of us hearing this are guilty of that. But it's strong language, and so because we have the potential for being guilty of it, I think we ought to take it seriously and look at the reason why it's foolish and why it's evil. To put all of my weight, my confidence in my resources and my plans. And of course, we sang one song about it specifically tonight. This life is no longer mine. It's odd that how many Christians I've met that wanted Jesus to take away their sins, but they didn't actually want to give him their life. They wanted God as their consultant. They wanted God as their, you know, bankroll, but they didn't want him actually running anything. And I was with a guy one time talking to a very wealthy businessman who sometimes attended church, and he had on his desk a little plaque that said, God is my partner. And this person that I was with was a lot more blunt than I am. And he says, well, does he get to make any of the decisions? And does he get any of the money? And there was a lot of sputtering and snorting and huffing and puffing, because that was not a fair question, because it just sounded noble to say God is my partner. Well, that's not always the case. So let's look at what James says here. Listen, you say, today or tomorrow we'll go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Is that wrong? Is it wrong to make a plan? Is it wrong to make money? Is it wrong to carry on business? Well, no, it's not. That's life. I think if you rewinded a few verses and you look at the, and get a run at what James has been talking about the things that cause strife amongst humans. Remember, he said it's because basically we are living for ourselves, even as Christians, when the strife comes, because there's an internal battle between the Spirit of God wanting God to rule and me wanting to get my needs met and using other people as instruments to fulfill me or to meet my needs. And that internal battle is what causes the quarreling and the striving. And he wraps up that passage in verse 10 by saying, humble yourselves, therefore, in the sight of the Lord, and he'll lift you up. And I think this is in the same context that he addresses arrogant self-confidence, confidence in our plans, confidence in our abilities, and I mean, that's something Americans pride themselves in. If you listen to the people who have rewritten history of our country, they would intimate that that's the way we've always been. But all you have to do is read some of the writings of our founding fathers, and you realize these were men who were keenly aware that they would not have a country if it were not for the grace of God. They were men who, for the most part, were humble before God. It's interesting, when we go to Israel, those of you that go to Israel will see something that it's kind of heart-wrenching in a way, to see that Israel today, the one people on the face of the earth who have the longest history of the faithfulness of God, do not think of themselves as being blessed by God. They look to themselves as the instrument of their protection. They say, we're prosperous and we're protected because we're vigilant. And God really doesn't get credit for it, which is really sad. There are just too many stories of how he's just saved their necks time after time after time. And I think that we as a nation are sort of perilously close to being in that same place. So humbling ourselves, as James says in verse 10, should carry over into the way that we look at the future and the way we live. I wanted to make a couple of notes about this rhetorical quote, if that's even a proper grammar. Today or tomorrow we'll go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Do you notice all those plans are worldly plans? God's really not factored into that. The word God really isn't in that. And he talks about how foolish it is to make those kind of plans with that kind of arrogant self-confidence. In verse 14, he says, well, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. I don't know where the quote came from, but Pastor Chuck was the first one I ever heard say it years ago when I first started going to Calvary Chapel. He used to say, blessed are the flexible, for they shall not be broken. And I'm sure it didn't come from him. I've seen it in other places. But it speaks of, it's really actually a pretty good thing to hang on to. Inflexible people who have confidence in their own abilities and their own plans to the extent that they never allow for contingencies, people like that are in danger. The more that we lean on our own plans and our own abilities, and the more possible danger we are in. And I believe that this whole thing that James is saying here is spoken for our protection. It's foolish when you don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow to lean all your weight on your plans. Best be flexible, because you don't know what's going to happen. I used to think I was that way. In fact, that was sort of my motto, predictability with flexibility. And it sounded so noble and, far thinking and, flexible kind of guy. But see, my idea of flexibility was I had 5 backup plans if my original plan didn't work. So my idea of flexibility was, God, here's the best way to do it, and here's the 5 backup plans that I've come up with that you have to choose from. You see the one folly in that? I used to say, now God, these are my plans, now bless my plans, and I used to feel so good that I had included God. God, here, bless these plans, Lord. In fact, bless these 5 backup plans, just in case this one doesn't work. But do you see the problem in that? The problem is they're still my plans. And out of one side of my mouth, I'm saying I belong to God, and out of the other side of my mouth, it's all my plans. And he doesn't have room. 9/11 should have told us that the world is an unstable place. Shouldn't it have done that? For a while it did. People completely changed the way they lived their lives for a while. Some of the social anthropologists that studied the behavior, especially of New Yorkers for the period of time, says that feeling of looking at your life completely differently and living different lasted 110 days. And then it was business as usual. Now, in that 110 days, some people just said, that's it, I'm out of here. And in fact, I met a couple that moved up here just because And they knew they were going to take a hit in their finances, but they just realized, you know, the guy was in the Twin Towers when they went down, and he was one of the lucky ones that escaped alive. And he realized that when I didn't kiss my wife goodbye that morning, because I was in too big of a hurry to get there early to get a leg up on the competition, he said, I did not realize that, obviously, that there was a possibility I'd never see her again. And so he made adjustments. My father, in a hurry to get to work, kissed my mom goodbye, thought, well, I won't take my aspirin and I won't eat my banana that the doctor told me I needed. And of course, he hadn't done that for 2 or 3 days earlier. And my father, 72 years old, to make some extra money on the way home from work, delivered a piano by himself, and driving through an intersection, his heart stopped. And he slumped over the steering wheel, and the car kept going and ran into a building. Somebody saw this happen and dialed 911, and the paramedic station was 3 blocks away. But by the time all of this happened and they got my father's heart started again, he suffered brain damage. And he spent the last 8 years of his life in a nursing home, sometimes able to know who we were and sometimes not able to know who we were. And that one morning that he kissed my mom goodbye, neither one of them knew that they were never going to have each other as best friends ever again. Now, I'm not saying that to scare anybody, but folks, that's the reality of our life. And there I could tell you plenty of stories, people you know. None of us are guaranteed tomorrow. We aren't. So, isn't it foolish to put all of our weight on our plans for the future? I can tell you personally from experience that stuff can happen that you just did not see coming. And all of the work and all of the, you know, and I had lots of plans. And all of the work that you were going to fulfill those plans can all go down the drain in 1 minute. There's only one safe place to put our weight. And James tells us in verse 15, let me finish verse 14 first. You don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, your posture ought to be, your attitude ought to be, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. And I want to talk about this from this. That's the title of our study tonight, and we'll spend a little bit of our time on this and then the rest of our time on the first part of chapter 5. This is kind of a little colloquialism, almost a little, one of these little sayings people have. The Lord willing, I've said it, you've said it. And it's just a thing that we say. In Psalm 39, it's the psalm I always read when I do a funeral for a young person. Verses 4 through 6, David says, Lord, teach me to number my days correctly, because before you my life is just a breath. Teach me to number my days correctly. If the Lord wills, what that means is not, these are my plans unless God stops me. That's sort of Islamic. You know, the whole thing with Islam is, if I punch you in the nose because I'm mad, I can say, well, it was Allah's will that I punched you in the nose. And you can shift the blame off on Allah, because you can say, well, if Allah didn't want me to punch you in the nose, he wouldn't have let me punch you in the nose. So because I did punch you in the nose, therefore it's Allah's will. I've heard Christians use that same kind of sort of twisted logic. And I think I think this is an important thing to have a clear view on. I look this word, this verb up, if the Lord wills. My NIV says, if the Lord is willing, and that's a little bit misleading. It's not a correct translation of the Greek. The word wills, the verb, is the verb thelo, and it speaks of something which God desires, which must be done.